Welcome to Documentary First, an inside look at a documentary filmmaker's journey. I'm your host, Josh Lindsay from the Movie Proposal Podcast. And with us is our documentary filmmaker, Christian Taylor.
Hey, Josh, how you doing?
Good, Christian. How are you?
Good, thank you. Happy to be here. Happy to be alive. Trying to be happy, actually. It's kind of a, you know, kind of a down day for me.
Well, it's cold. It's winter. It's January. Say no more.
You have to spend some time with us.
I know. Actually, I'm feeling much better already.
And if you didn't recognize that voice, that's our trusty, dusty, research extraordinaire, button-pushing guy living in his basement, Jason Rugg.
Hey there.
And we have a very special guest with us today, Michelle Phoenix, who is the writer and narrator for Grueling Glory. Michelle, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
And so we're going to hear a little bit about Grueling Glory. If you don't know, in a minute, but if you don't know who Michelle is, she works full-time for Mission Go, helping expat missionary families, primarily working with kids. So I want to hear about that too. So thank you again for being with us, Michelle. But before we jump in to Michelle's story, Christian, what is going on in the film world?
Yeah, so today it is January 6th, 2022, and we are still trying to get our head around this new branding that we're doing. So if you're just catching up with us, we have just rebranded under a new umbrella called Documentary First. So our podcast has sort of charted the course for us. And I started off, you know, really actually trying to be an actress and ended up being a filmmaker with The Girl Who Wore Freedom. Many people know this already. And but in the course of that, discovered that I really did love making films and had a knack for it. So out of that grew this other little short that we're talking about today, Grueling Glory. And we have three other projects in the works right now, The Brave Dutch, the Carentan documentary series, as well as another one called Dear Donna, which I've talked about a long time ago. It's really, really in the pre-development stage, but it is a documentary about Donna Reed and the GIs from World War II that used to write her letters. So we got a bunch of projects in the crock pot right now, and we figured we wanted to be able to talk about all of them on social media and on our websites and things like that. So we've now been trying to do the reorganization in our company, and that's tedious things like reorganizing all of our Trello work world, our Google Drives, and our Slack communication channels and things like that. Stuff that's not fun at all, which probably has contributed to my winter blues along with battling COVID still. So yeah, not a lot of exciting stuff still happening, but, you know, and then we did get some disappointing news yesterday I was really surprised about, and that is that Grueling Glory was not accepted into the Beaufort Film Festival in South Carolina, which I was really shocked about. That's the film festival that was, in February last year, The Girl Who Wore Freedom won the duty and honor category. We also won the audience award and made a lot of really good friends down there. And I thought for sure I'd be a shoo-in with Grueling Glory. But that was not to be. So, so that was kind of a bummer, but, there is good news on the Grueling Glory front. I was glad, Michelle, when we connected about you coming on here, you asked me about sort of what was going on with Grueling Glory so that I could take a step back and kind of look at things. And so when I went into my film festival profile, and dug around, I realized that we had been accepted into five film festivals, and that and that was more than I thought. I thought at the time it was like three. So let me tell everybody what those are to begin with. So Grueling Glory has been accepted into the Mediterranean Film Festival, Cannes. It was accepted into Scorpius Fest, which is in Park City, Utah, into Flathead Lake International Cinema Fest, where it is a nominee for the Best Short Documentary. That's exciting. That's going to be at the end of January. We were accepted into the Berlin Short Awards, and we were a semifinalist. and we were accepted into the Lonely Wolf International Film Festival, and we were a semi-finalist there. So the news is not all bad. I do think that there have been, you know, some rejections, like I said, that I was surprised about. One of them is the Beaufort one. We were also not accepted to the Chandler International Film Festival. We also won an award there last year. We didn't get into the Montgomery Film Festival. Sadly, we did not get into Sundance. What a shock. The Spokane International Film Festival and the New Jersey Film Festival, we did not get into. So, however, we have about 55 other film festival things where we are still being considered. So, you know, it's just the beginning. We'll see what happens next. But it's kind of looking like a mixed bag at the moment.
Which is normal, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, when you look at, if I go to the Girl Who Wore Freedom, I haven't done this in a long time, but, if I go, you can go on your dashboard and you can look at sort of like what your percentage acceptance rates are. And so the selection rate for the Girl Who Wore Freedom, it looks like we had 151 total submissions, 33 selections. And so we had a 23% selection rate, and that's actually really pretty high. And I'm looking now at Grueling Glory. Right now we've had 63 total submissions, 5 selections and 52 pending with a 45% selection rate. So as of right now, we're looking pretty good if you compare it to the Girl Who Wore Freedom.
Yeah. It makes a difference when you have perspective, right?
Yeah.
Everything's relative.
For sure. For sure. Yeah.
Well, that's good. All right. And Netflix hasn't called you yet? Because that's what everyone really cares about. Where is Netflix?
I know. You know, I have not heard from Virgil Films at all. So I don't really know what they've heard. Although I do think if they'd have gotten a call from Netflix, I would have heard about them pretty quickly. So I am still waiting to hear back about that. And
which, you know, that's going to take a while. I mean, you know, they all took the month of December off. They're getting back. They're trying to get caught with emails and things like that. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if you didn't hear till like February, March, to be quite honest, but not that I know anything. It's just human nature, right?
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting though. I got to say, I ran across a film two nights ago on Netflix called Radium Girls. Radium Girls is a narrative feature film that I'm aware of because my mentor, Neil Akins from the Stony Brook School, he is an incredible theater actor, and this was his very one and only film role. And I learned about this like 3 years ago. He told me he had done it, and I started researching it to find out if it had gotten distribution or anything like that. So I've been aware of it now for a couple of years and saw that it was supposed to be released, and it finally just showed up on Netflix. And I watched it last night. And although Neil's performance was fabulous, and I was so proud of him, the film itself, you know, really was just not great. But here it is on Netflix. And that's true for so many Netflix films. And I'm like, you know, I just don't understand why we would have a difficult time getting on Netflix with the quality of our film and how well it's done. It's just totally befuddling to my mind is what Netflix decides to take and pay money for and what they don't.
Well, it's like, and I don't know how they operate either, but if you ever go to Redbox, which I haven't done in a while, but Redbox has some of the most random movies in the world, and you can just tell they're terrible. but apparently it keeps them in business. And so there's got to be some matrix, some thought process, you know, that obviously they want good films, Netflix does, but they have a lot. Because they want to offer, because it can be, I don't know what the word is, but it can be tailored to someone. So if people like to watch a lot of B films, you know, horrible horror films or stupid documentary or whatever, they can just put it on there and it'll be tailored to an audience and make money off of that. So I don't think it's just, we only put good films on Netflix.
There's also a lot of bargaining that goes on in those sorts of things. So a lot of times if, you know, Virgil Films has a pack of 10 films and they go, these 5 are fantastic, but you only get those five if you also take these five that nobody else wants. Like, that's usually how a lot of these things actually get them distributed. If they're not selling, they're not doing well, is usually you package them with something else, or you bundle them with something else and say, you can only have this stuff if you also take this stuff. Yes. So that's oftentimes
sounds like the government, how laws get passed, you know,
pretty much. Yeah. You only get the girl who wore freedom if you build a bridge in Wisconsin.
Yeah. So that's about all the news I have to report about that.
Okay. Well, hey, let's shift gears. We have a very special guest today, Michelle. Thanks for being patient. Why don't you tell us first, before we dive into grueling glory, about what you do? So you said you work with expats, working with kids. Tell us about your job.
Yeah, I was, the reason that I met Christian is that I was born and raised in France and I'm fluent in French. And the reason that was is that my parents were missionaries in France for 37 years. So I grew up in the French school system, then went to Wheaton College and decided to go back to the high school for missionaries kids that I had taught at for 20 years as an adult. I had graduated from there as well. And while I was there, started to really realize that this unique people group of missionaries kids, or MKs or TCKs, third culture kids, that they have some really specific strengths and some really specific challenges, the latter of which are often overlooked by adults who can't fully relate to what it is to grow up in a ministry culture between worlds. So I left BFA Black Forest Academy, that school, after teaching there for 20 years, and launched this global work, helping parents to understand their students, helping teachers of third culture kids to understand the kids that they're teaching better, helping organizations that send families overseas to prepare them better, and especially to welcome them home in a helpful way, because that is a capital T traumatic experience for many of these families. So that's my life, day in, day out, in many different ways. A lot of that can be found on my website, michellephoenix.com. A lot of articles and resources that I'm creating and consulting with parents all around the world. I love what I do.
That's awesome.
You are uniquely crafted to do that, Michelle. I mean, I think it's your history and your background is so interesting and eclectic and perfect for what you're doing. And it made it perfect for you to help us as well. I mean, I just love it that you were able to jump on and join our totally different and random task.
Random is the right word. It came out of nowhere. Yeah.
But it was great. We were so happy to have you here. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead, Josh. What was your next question?
Well, I don't know, Christian or Michelle, either one of you can answer this question. Just first remind everyone what Grueling Glory is. And then I'd like to hear about how Michelle got involved in that.
Yeah, let me take this one. So Grueling Glory is a 9-minute short that we filmed at the same time that we filmed The Girl Who Wore Freedom. And I did this in a really non-traditional way. Typically, when a first-time filmmaker does something, they release a short first as proof of concept and figuring out how to do it all, and then they'll release the longer version later. We kind of did it in the reverse. I didn't even know how things were supposed to be done, of course. But as we were going through this project, we were trying to raise money and awareness for The Girl Who Wore Freedom, and we were asking people to write blog post in order to put on our website so that we could share on social media and begin engaging an audience. And not only does she work with third culture kids, but Michelle is also a writer. And she can tell you as well about the books that she's written, but she's an accomplished writer. And so we tapped into her gifts to write a blog post for us. And she had written this one, Grueling Glory, March to Carentan, about one of her experiences in the D-Day, you know, filming event that we did. And when I read it, it was very moving. And it was interesting to me because it took, you know, whereas The Girl Who Wore Freedom looked at all of the events in the sum total of that and what that said, Michelle had one unique independent experience in one event. And that's what this story was about. And so I liked it that it was just a singular experience and you could do a deep dive into this event. And when I read it, I thought, we have enough extra footage that we could turn this little piece into a short, and, you know, let people meet one of our heroes, you know, in particular, and learn a little bit more about this very dramatic, engaging event called The Exodus, in Carentan. So I also thought that it would keep our team, you know, developing their skills. And if we were able to win some awards and do well on the circuit, we would be able to add to our resume. So that was a whole another reason of being able to put it out there, show that our company is continuing to work and to do things and not just sitting idle. So, in short, that's what Grueling Glory is. Eventually the history for this film, it really, will do its film festival run and then probably live on our website as a nice little homage to Tom Rice and to our translator, Michelle Phoenix.
And a little postscript to that is that I was actually, I think it was a year ago, I was in quarantine in Canada for 14 days in hardcore quarantine. And I was just going to take this article that I had written and all the pictures I had taken on that day and make it into a little PowerPoint, MacGyver it into something worth looking at. And then I wrote to Christian and asked if I could use some of the music from our original movie. And that's when you said, well, wait a minute, how about we collaborate on this and do it up good and use moving pictures and music as well. So, and Jeff Kurtenacker actually wrote the music for this short as well.
Yeah, he wrote new music for the short. We're going to have him on next week to talk about that. Mm-hmm. I feel like if you just say, hey, to Jeff, hey, can you cook up something to go with this? He'll be like, sure, here you go. I mean, he's always just so great.
He's amazing. He also did the soundtrack for my book release video trailer. And I wrote to him. And about 2 days later, I had this beautiful kind of military inspired music to go along with a book trailer.
Yeah, he's incredible. We love you, Jeff. Anyway, so yeah, that's it from my perspective. So Michelle, why don't you talk a little bit about this day? This little short looks at this one event on one day in Normandy in 2018. Tell us how you even ended up at this event.
Yeah. It was the typical day for me on this shoot in that I woke up in the morning, I got into the car I was told to get into, and I went to the place I was told to go to. And a lot of the times I had really no idea what I was up for when the car doors open and I got out, but I knew that I was going to translate something in two languages. And on this day, you, Christian, and half the team were on another shoot somewhere else, and you sent me to La Barquette, which is a set of locks in France. So it's kind of like a mechanism to hold back water. So I went with our friend Flo Boucherie and a couple of our guys, including your son Christian, who took the picture of me and Tom Rice that's featured also in the documentary. So we got there. We were out in the middle of the fields, literally cows and horses running around. And here we are set up with a couple news trucks, if I remember correctly, who are also there to do some videoing. And the first thing I saw was off in the distance, and I could hear them come before I could see them, because these, again, are hedgerow rimmed roads, right, in Normandy. You don't have a lot of view off the side of the roads, but I could hear their shuffling. I could hear boots coming my way. And as they turned the corner and approached, I saw what I thought was going to be a dozen men that turned into probably a couple hundred men and a few women included in this group of people who are all dressed in 1944 military garb, American military garb, most of them. I found out later that for some of them, they were actually wearing real vintage uniforms and carrying real vintage items that our GIs would have carried back in on June 6, 1944. Some of them had reproductions that they were wearing, but what struck me was the look on their faces as they approached. They were so weary. It was, by Normandy standards, a really hot day, and they had been walking from Utah Beach, which was, I think, about 10 kilometers away, maybe 6-7 miles away, in their full gear, carrying everything that they were carrying, retracing the steps of the Allied forces who also landed on Utah Beach on June 6, 1944. So they had been walking under a beating sun. They were very disorganized, kind of a ragtag bunch of men and a few women. I'll keep throwing that in. And as they arrived where we were, some other people, villagers from the nearby town of Carentan, turned up as well. And these were mostly women dressed, again, in period garb, who had baskets full of apples and very modern water bottles, but we won't mention that, and things to give these men who were so exhausted. So they kind of had a picnic stop right where we were, and there wasn't much talking going on among them. It felt like they were embedded with the ghosts of the soldiers who had come before them. There was a degree of respect and pensiveness, contemplation in them. And so we started getting the footage that we needed. I spoke with a couple of them as they were kind of lounging in the grass around us. And then I heard the sound of a 1944 Jeep siren in the distance. And this fabulous old Jeep rounded the same corner. And in the front seat was, who I now know, was this wonderful veteran called Tom Rice with the 101st Airborne, the Screaming Eagles. And he got out of the Jeep, and I wish I could adequately describe these 100, 200 men exhausted, lying in the grass, drinking their water, who saw the veteran appear. And it's like a new energy possessed them. And they got up and they lined up into two immaculately straight lines as Tom Rice stepped out of the Jeep. And then there was a moment when he looked around, and I now know, having learned more of his story, that this field, it's not a dam, what's it called? A lock. That these locks are exactly where he fought on June 6, 1944. He had landed off target a couple kilometers north of there, actually. His entire stick of paratroopers had been dispersed because they had been hit by flak and the plane was off target and going too fast and flying too low. And he'd found a couple of his comrades in arms, and they had made their way to these locks. And part of the story that isn't in our short that I love is that in order to travel light, he had taken out his most prized possession from his knapsack. And that was a bottle of maple syrup that he brought from home with him, which he would never find again. It's somewhere on the side of a road in Normandy, probably to this day. But Tom Rice got out of the Jeep and looked around, and you could see the memory wash over his face. And Christian, this is something we saw, right? With so many of the veterans that we interviewed, when they started talking about their experiences or revisiting the places where their experiences had happened, there's something that comes over their face. Their eyes almost glaze over, and it's like they're going back in time. So I think these 200 men, reenactors, gave Tom just a few moments to get his bearings and compose himself. And then he walked very slowly and regally between these two lines of reenactors who were dressed just as his comrades in arms would have been in, at that point, 74 years before. So he always travels, or frequently travels, in Normandy with this wonderful Frenchman by the name of Denis Van den Brieck. And he was there with him. And as Tom got to the end of this row of men, Denis started asking him questions about what his experiences had been right there. This man who at that point, I think, was 97 and would the next day jump out of a C-47 at age 97 with a paratrooper behind him. It was a tandem jump, so he didn't jump alone, but 97 years old jumping out of a plane, and he plans on doing it in Coronado this summer for his 100th birthday. He started asking Tom Rice these questions, and the memories that he had. He remembers exactly how many stakes they planted in the ground to set up a perimeter. And he remembers tying metallic wire to each of the stakes and then hanging from that wire anything that would make noise. This was their kind of MacGyver version of security as they were facing off with German forces who wanted to take the locks, because if they could open them, they could flood the land around it and they would stop the Allies from getting to Carentan. And Carentan was a really strategic town for them to reach. So I stood there and listened to Tom, and again, watched the expressions on his faces, and his recollections were so precise that it felt like you were right there with him. And then I need to add that he was also accompanied after the Jeep arrived, a couple buses arrived, and there were 100 active duty American soldiers who were following Tom on this day as he went from place to place where he had fought. So for these young men and women today to be able to be on the ground and hear these stories of a war that feels so almost mystical, right, in our minds and not so realistic anymore today, to hear the details from the horse's mouth, I think was a really impactful thing for those soldiers as well. So that's what happened right there. Do you want me to go on to the exodus in Carentan?
Yeah, I mean, you guys hung out there for a while, Tom talked, and then what happened next?
So then we all got in our vehicles again, him in his Jeep, the soldiers in their buses, and me in whatever car Flo and I were in. And we headed to the town of Carentan, which is maybe another 5 miles away, which the reenactors were going to continue walking on foot with all of their stuff, equipment on their backs. And we were in Carentan for quite a while before our reenactors got there, which gave me the really unique opportunity to stand on the sidewalk with so many people lined up waiting for the exodus to happen. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that. But as I'm standing on the sidewalk, a gentleman who owned a cheese store, because France, behind me pulled up a chair next to me and helped his father into it. This was a 95-year-old gentleman who had been in Carentan the day that it was liberated. His name was Albert. And he was really shaky and teary. And I kind of tried to surreptitiously take a picture of him. And he said, "You're taking a picture of me?" in French. And I said, "I just want to talk to you." So I got down on my haunches next to him and heard his story of what life had been like in Carentan before it was liberated. And of he was, I think, 15 or 16 when the liberation happened. And he, the emotions coming from him as he recalled life under German occupation, was really important for me to fully understand what was going to come next. He is a beautiful soul, Albert. He has now departed this world, but what an honor it was to be able to kind of sit at his feet and hold his hand and hear his stories of what it was like for a French young man who was entrusted with providing for his family to live through those years of deprivation and occupation. And then another event happened. The spectators kind of stood back to open up the street. And I would say easily 100 inhabitants of Carentan, modern day people, these are not very elderly people, but they had dressed again in period garb, and they reenacted what the French call the Exodus, what the Carentan people call the Exodus, which is people from the town at the time piling their entire lives up on horse-drawn carriages and on their backs and in whatever they could find to leave the city before the fighting began. And it is, you'll see it in the short. It is such a beautiful, moving moment to see people looking like the French did back in 1944, leaving with all they could load onto their backs and onto their carriages and trying to get out of town because their lives were so threatened. And there were children in this parade. The elderly, the young, people who probably spent an awful lot of time in the past few years gathering up all these items that look like authentic 1944 France in order to reenact this moment. And right behind them, with another sound of a Jeep siren, came these 200 reenactors. And now they were in formation. I don't know how many of them speak English, but they were chanting the military chants in English with strong accents as they walked past us on the street, carrying the American flag. I looked down at Albert, who was still sitting in the chair next to me, and there are just tears rolling off of his cheeks as he relives the freeing of the town that was his all those years ago. And I think that there were more men now among their ranks than there had been out in the fields. It went on forever. And they passed us on the street to the main square. And then you'll see the beautiful footage in the short of them circling the square with people, the French people cheering them on, the people who had come before who were in period garb as well, cheering them on as they would have been cheered on back in 1944 when the town was liberated. It was like stepping back in time with the hindsight that allows for, I think, even greater appreciation of what that moment is. It was stepping back in time and understanding that I was standing on liberated French soil with people who spoke French, with people who were no longer suffering from the tyranny of Nazi Germany. It was a life-altering moment for me. I actually went back and wrote the article that this short is based on that night. And then when Christian asked for it, I think probably a year later, I kind of worked on it some more. And between those two times, I got to speak more with Tom. I tracked him down online, and he became the military and historical advisor for my book that deals in part with D-Day, with June 6, 1944. And it retraces just a little bit of his story. It really is aimed more to honor him than to retell his story. But a lot of the details in the book are actually Tom's, and he has read it cover to cover with the help of one of his friends who takes care of him out in Coronado, California. And I'm just so, so, so honored that that day in Carentan and this grueling glory march on Carentan, that it led to this kind of connection with a man who is the kind of hero that we won't be able to meet a whole lot in the years ahead. He went on from Normandy to fight, I wrote it down, to fight in Market Garden in the Ardennes. He was wounded in Bastogne, and then he was part of the fighting around Eagle's Nest when they actually took Eagle's Nest later on.
Yeah, he's a remarkable man.
So can you talk a little bit, Michelle? I mean, you've never worked on a documentary film before, correct?
Correct.
So what, so you were, you wrote, you're the writer for Grueling Glory. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the process of that and maybe the back and forth, the dialogue, you know, you and Christian had, you know, just what that's like?
Yeah.
The process.
There wasn't really a whole lot of back and forth, right, Christian? Because it was an already written piece that was designed for the blog when it was released then. But we did do a lot of back and forth with Christian and with our editor, trying to figure out, because I also wrote it and recorded it in French. That's the other piece of this. So we did a lot of interacting with each other just about what footage to put with what parts of the story. And then because translation, you have to take some liberties and rearrange some of the words and the thoughts. Then when we did the French version, we had to move some of the footage around as well, so it would match just right. That was kind of fun because Christian understands a lot of French now. Our editor does not, Bill Evil does not. And so to try and tell him exactly where one thought ends in the French language and the next video needs to begin was a creative process in itself, I think. But I'm so pleased that my little idea of putting still pictures with it turned into this, because there's no, I mean, still versus movie, right? This is movie images, so beautifully shot, and they just add another dimension to the story.
Yeah, I mean, you had a very, very special day, you know, and there were, as I look at it, you know, like three different little elements to that. It really, really remarkable. And I'm so thankful that you have the ability to articulate that. I mean, we haven't talked about this here, but it is true. You are an accomplished photographer, in my opinion. You have a very good eye. And you had taken some of, you know, a lot of the photographs that we do use on our social media and stuff, you did take, because we didn't really have an official behind the scenes photographer. That became you. And so you are so incredibly artistically gifted in so many ways. And you were just the right person to be there at that day, because you spoke both languages, you understood and were aware and sensitive to the history. You could talk with the people that were there in their native language. And then you were able to recount all of that in writing in French and in English. So we've captured something this special day in your life in a very remarkable way. I wish that you had when we were in France, you actually took your conversation with Albert and you had put it into a slideshow that you did share on social media at the time. And I mean, I don't know that that still can be viewed, but it was pretty powerful in itself, just that little conversation with him.
Yeah. I think it's still on my Facebook somewhere. I can post it again for anybody who wants to see it. Michelle Phoenix on Facebook. But yeah, that I think those two events on the same day really cemented that day as just spectacular in all the days that I was there and in all the wonderful interviews and encounters that happened. There was something about that 1-2 punch of Albert and Tom Rice, of the French citizen and the American soldier, the American paratrooper, that just really cemented that day in my memory.
Yeah. One of my favorite moments is what you talked about. My favorite moments in this little short is when they come marching into Carentan and you can hear them in their American, quote unquote, I'm using air quotes, American accents, counting off their steps and chanting. I get chills when you see they have pulled themselves together and they're marching into town and
so proud, so proud.
So proud. Yeah. And you know, they should be, because not all of them marched the 10 miles from Utah Beach or whatever it is. But I mean, it's a long march in very uncomfortable clothes, you know, on a lot of, you know, beaches and fields and all this other stuff. It's an accomplishment to do the Exodus.
It is. And to them, it really is that the aura of honor that comes off of them, they're honoring their heroes in the same way that little kids wear their Marvel's heroes suits, right? Only this time it's in the place where real history happened, with real men who sacrificed and women who sacrificed their lives. And there's just something so rare about that. It's all honor. No, you know, they don't get paid for it. They don't get any recognition for it. They come from all over Europe. We met some of them on the day Tom jumped. We met some of them on whatever that alley, what's that alley
called? Purple Heart Lane.
Purple Heart Lane. And some of them were German and there were some who were Dutch, and they just come from all over Europe so that they can step nearly literally into the shoes of these people who liberated their land.
Yeah. That's super cool. You know, I don't want us to leave this podcast without you telling people the name of your book, because I want people to be able to find that.
Yeah. It's called Fragments of Light. I actually happen to have a copy sitting right next to me. That might be backwards on your screens, but this is what it looks like. Published by HarperCollins, Thomas Nelson. And it's a dual timeline story. Part of it is about a World War II hero who jumped over Normandy on D-Day and was wounded, sent back home, and disappeared 2 months later, trying to figure out what happened to him as his daughter approaches the end of her life. And then the other half of it is a woman who has just come through her own battle with breast cancer and is trying to make her life back into something she recognizes. And she decides, for her best friend's sake, that she needs to find out what happened to this man who jumped over Normandy. So it's a dual timeline story. A lot of the places in Normandy are exactly the places I visited, that I described as close to real as I could, as close to accurately as I could. Some of the people that we had in the documentary, their names appear in the book too. There's Flo, there's Danny, there's all of those names that appear in there just to honor them as well. But it is a fictional story. It's not a biography.
Awesome.
All right, that'll be your next movie.
I dare you.
Someone tell Christian she can't do it, and then
that's right. That's the way it works, isn't it?
That usually in the past has been how it works traditionally. But I will have to say, I think I am going to restrict myself to the documentary world.
Yes.
I'm still trying to figure that out. That whole narrative world is a completely different animal.
It is.
A year from now, you're going to be rebranding again from documentary films to whatever films.
Documentaries and movies first.
Oh, goodness. Who knows? Well, thank you, Michelle, for your creative gifts, sharing them with us. You know, you've given us something that I think will honor Tom and those that honor him for quite a long time. And we're, if you want to be able to see Grueling Glory, there is really only one way you can see Grueling Glory right now. I guess there's two. One is to see it at a film festival, and it's coming up in, at the end of January in Polson, Montana. That's where the Flathead Lake International Cinema Fest is. Otherwise known as Flick Film Festival. You can see it in Polson, Montana, or I'm going to make it available to our Patreon subscribers. So we can kind of do that privately in our Patreon portal. So if you've been thinking about becoming a Patreon supporter, now is a great time to do that. In the next week or so, we're going to be sharing that with our Patreon supporters so that they can be able to get the first look at that. And also, I did, you know, take a bunch of really interesting things, videos and pictures when I was over in Normandy a couple of weeks ago, and we're going to be sharing those with our Patreon supporters as well. So this is a really good time to join Patreon. You're going to start getting a lot of really interesting stuff. So, Jason, any questions for Michelle? Yeah, go ahead.
Actually, I just wanted to clarify the, if you want to go to Patreon, it's not patreon.com/docfirstpodcast anymore. It is patreon.com/docfirst. So documentary first, sorry. So we've updated that slug. So you can find it that way.
Say it one more time.
It's patreon.com/documentary first.
There you go. Excellent.
Can I just jump in to say thank you
for
hiring me to be a translator. And I jumped into something that I didn't know. I had no idea what it was going to be. And those were truly some of the greatest memories and encounters of my life. So I'm so grateful for the opportunity to be a part of it.
Well, it was our pleasure. And, you know, we both share a common faith in God, and we do believe that he brought us together. And it's clear to me that, you know, we were supposed to do this together, you know, for many different reasons. And so it's been a pleasure to work with you, Michelle. And thank you so much for, you know, being part of our little team.
It's been my joy.
Christian, any final updates you wanted to point out? Any reminders for our listeners?
Yes, actually, we are going to start adding a new segment to Documentary First. Dun, 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 dun. Yeah. We got to come up with some sort of catchy theme song or something, but this is going to be your Documentary First documentary recommendation segment. I don't know, or my favorite documentary of the week or something like that.
You gotta work on that.
Yeah, we'll work on it. Got to workshop that. But I saw a documentary this week that I just have to talk about. And it was a total surprise. I was flipping around Netflix and it popped up called Bathtubs Over Broadway. Hadn't heard anything about it before. And I was, you know, very curious and quite skeptical. But I was won over instantly, like in the first 5 minutes. And it is now skyrocketed to one of my favorite documentaries. Jason, I had told you to pull it up earlier. Did you pull it up? Can you read the, you know, its little log line or whatever you got there?
Yeah. So it's a late night comedy writer stumbles upon a hilarious hidden world of corporate entertainment and finds an unexpected connection to his fellow man.
Yeah. So the writer is the head comedy writer for David Letterman. Years ago, he was in charge of going to record stores, finding these old records that, you know, David Letterman would sort of make fun of on the air. And it developed a habit for him, an interest in finding these really unique off the beaten path records. And so this turned into an obsession for him, which, I'm not going to spoil it. All I'm going to say is the documentary gets better and better and better as it goes along. And I was in tears at the end, tears of joy. It's so heartwarming, hilariously funny, completely obscure. And I really related with him, with the writer, the filmmaker, because near the end, what he was absorbing as he was processing this experience, because it was a journal of discovery, just like The Girl Who Wore Freedom was for me, is he was taking note of what had happened to him, you know, through his, you know, through his journey. And it really was about the people and the community that he had built. And that was what was so rewarding for him. And it all started because of this really unique, bizarre interest that he had that he decided to pursue. So definitely a documentary worth watching. And next week, we're going to have another one. We're going to start every week. We're going to come with a new documentary to recommend. I have one other thing. Sandy Gordon was on the show a couple of weeks ago, and she and I have been talking a little bit more since then. She texted me the other day out of the blue and told me that I had to get this book. And this book is called The Movie Business Book by Jason E. Squire. And it's a book that they're requiring at DePaul Film Schools of Cinematic Arts. And she said it was just, it kind of blew her mind what she was reading in here. And she was saying that it's not really written by one guy, but one guy put together from a whole bunch of different experts in the film business. You know, he said it's written, you know, there are articles in there from distributors, marketers, studio executives, agents, managers, people that handle the home videos, purchasing and the airplane purchasing. And so she says, it talks a lot about the inherent costs that most movie producers factor in, the lawyers and the accountants, to make sure that they keep the distributors in check. She said it's a very depressing book about how hard it is to make money in movies if it's not a Marvel movie. So she said, fair warning. She said one of the most fascinating things is that this book was updated in 2019, and it's all about how everything is moving toward big releases going straight to streaming or simultaneously to theater release. but the theaters were fighting for it. And that was before COVID. So anyway, I immediately ordered the book. I asked her if she would come on the show and she's like, well, I haven't even finished reading the book. And I was like, well, we need to do a book report. So hopefully I will talk her into to coming back on. But yeah, I ordered the book. You guys might want to check it out too. We could kind of all read it together. So, and that's about it from me. Next week, I think we're going to have Jeff Kurtnacker on, maybe Bill Liebel, maybe Jason Hoban. I'm trying to get the band back together. So we'll see how successful I am.
Awesome. Well, hey, Michelle, thanks again for being on and sharing with us. Jason, we never really thank you at the end.
That's fair. There's no reason to thank me. It's okay. Yeah.
But I do want to thank our listeners for listening to Documentary First.